What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Murder Unscripted. I am Ed Hydock, here with my co-host, the sunshine of my life, Melissa Spivey.
Obviously, I wrote that. But that's way better than being the hot mess express that I was last time.
You're still that, but you're also my sunshine.
Aww.
Well, we are not going to waste any time today because we have an incredibly special guest. And this woman is not only a survivor, but in her own words, a thriver, which we want to talk to her about that. So for nearly 4 years, Laura and her children were held captive and subjected to some horrific physical and mental abuse at the hands of Mansa Musa Muhammad. And he was a man who was supposed to help Laura in her time of need, but this courageous woman devised a plan to escape. And now she has turned her gut-wrenching ordeal into a platform to help victims of domestic violence by spreading word about her story. And she's appeared on several shows, including ID's House of Horrors, which is how we met, ironically. And she's done hundreds of interviews, including one with Anderson Cooper. She's a radio host at Cleveland's 95.9 FM. And most recently, her story became the subject of a Lifetime movie entitled The Girl in the Garage. But perhaps her biggest accomplishment of them all, Murder Unscripted Guest. So that's how you know you've made it, Melissa.
Obviously.
Please welcome Laura Cowan.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, guys. How's it going? I'm good. How are you?
We are well. Thank you so much for being here tonight on your day off.
Anything for you, Ed. You know, we go way back.
We do go way back. And that's why I was telling Melissa, I said, I was a guest on her radio show like 10 years ago. Just as
Was it that long?
It's been a long time. I feel like it has. Maybe it hasn't. How long have you had the show? Not 10 years.
No, not 10. Maybe good 4 or 5.
Then it was probably 4 or 5. Okay, you're right. Well, Laura, I want to start by saying, first of all, thank you for being here. And also the purpose of this is not to relive your nightmare. You have done that time and time again. Mm-hmm. But I do want to cover kind of a couple broad strokes because just so that anybody tuning in has some context as to why we're who we're speaking with, you know?
Yeah.
So we cover on this show a different theme every month, and February is obviously the month of love. And our idea was to highlight cases where people who went into a relationship or a situation believing one thing, and then it completely goes off the rails and it turns into something dire and sometimes deadly. Mm. And that being said, we've talked a lot about relationships lately, and that's why we chose your story, because to me, when you decided to move from Cleveland out to California, and eventually fell in love with Shabazz, you couldn't have imagined in your wildest dreams what this would have turned into. Is that fair?
Really fair. I had no inkling. Didn't see it coming whatsoever.
I want to talk about Shabazz for a minute because that's how we're just going to kind of glide into this whole thing. So he obviously had gotten himself into trouble, but he was the love of your life, wasn't he?
Exactly. He sure was. He was, oh God, tall, dark, charming, charismatic, real smart, you know, and a community-oriented person. He would get involved with community work and help the homeless or the soup lines or whatever was needed, you know, so that kind of drew me to him.
Mm-hmm. And what was it about his personality? He was pretty smooth too, wasn't he?
Yeah, a good talker. he drew a crowd every time he opened his mouth, you know, it was just people wanted to hear what he had to say. And that's how we met, you know, is in a parking lot. I was coming off from home from work and I stopped in a store and I came back out and it was like 30, 40 people around this car. And I'm like, what's going on over there? Somebody selling something? And as I got closer, I'm interested, you know, and it didn't look like a hostile crowd. They was like calm and relaxed and listening and nodding their heads at each other. I said, well, let me go over here and see what's going on. And he was talking and it's like, wow, he's really a nice looking guy, you know. Yeah. I kind of ignored him that first time and got in the car and left. But about a couple of days later, I went to the store again after work and he was out there again. So I said, I'm going to go over there this time and just see exactly what he's talking about, join the crowd and just say hello,
Outstanding.
And I did. Yeah, I did.
Well, our audience is familiar with kind of what you went through, which is why we don't need to have you kind of relive all this. But when they all know that about when Shabazz did get in trouble and went away for a couple of years, you were essentially tasked with being a single mother, keeping these businesses alive. And let's face it, yourself afloat while you were raising these children. So kind of talk to me about how that felt.
That felt horrible because he was the backbone of everything, the business and all. I wasn't business savvy like him. You know, he kept the books. He knew, ordered supplies. I was just mostly there for support. And we had two little small businesses. One was like a little bookstore, and it had different little artifacts, African goods and things like that inside, oils, incense, books. And across the street was like a little fish and chip restaurant. And we would run back and forth and try to operate both of them. So, when he went to jail, and it was federal time. So they gave him 5 years, and he served all five of it too, with no early release whatsoever. And when he went to jail, I tell you, that was it for me. Because Muhammad was about, I want to say, 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. And Miriam was just only 4 months.
Yeah, Miriam was a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was it for me. I was like, oh my gosh, trying to take care of those two and run both the business, still try to attend to his business and get an attorney. And, you know, it was just too much.
Sure.
So I ended up having to close both of them, unfortunately.
And I don't want to beleaguer this point, but that's kind of around the time that when he went away, is when you met Mansa Musa Muhammad. And to me, it seems like you were in a very vulnerable spot, given that what was on your plate, you know? Yeah. So I guess, was that what made you so accepting of Musa's offer?
Yeah, because I've seen Musa around a few times over at the restaurant, and a couple of other brothers in the neighborhood and from the mosque. And they would always come over and chit-chat with him. So I was familiar with him, but didn't really know him.
Okay.
And when everything happened, and of course the word got around and spread like wildfire, you know, throughout the community. And I talked to the imam around the corner at the mosque, and he said, I'll send someone over to help you. And sure enough, it was Musa. And he did try to help him and his son. We tried to run the restaurant and run the bookstore. But, you know, when you have a scandal like that, you know, you get less people coming to patronize your business. And money wasn't coming in, but bills was coming in. That's for sure.
They always do.
Yeah. So I just had to close them both up. And he helped me pack stuff up, and him and his son. So that's what the trust factor came in at. You know, he didn't show me any signs of anything else negative.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we spent January covering two of the bigger serial killers, Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy. And we actually spoke with, in Ted Bundy, we spoke with his cousin as our guest. And she said, she told us something that was echoed then when we interviewed a forensic psychologist in the Gacy case. Both of these killers, and almost all the killers we deal with, they hide in plain sight. They have the uncanny ability to just blend in. Is that kind of what Musa did? Like, you would never see it if you didn't know.
You never know when you get on a bus or you go in a crowd of people and you sit down next to someone you just don't know, you know? And he just didn't fit that bill at all later, you know, after seeing everything about him. Yeah, but yeah, he was so charming, helpful, kind, considerate, everything, like, you know, just.
He had everybody fooled.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, this is a little bit off topic, but can you give me an overview of what the Nation of Islam is, because and kind of what it stands for? Because I gave the kind of basic Google search explanation, but I felt severely undereducated about it and to go into much detail. But I do find it incredibly interesting that Musa essentially weaponized it. Like, that's kind of what he did, right? He claimed the treatment of everyone in that house was part of this bigger plan.
Well, with the Nation of Islam, they're more like a set, a spinoff, if you will, from like Sunni Muslims. And they're geared more towards self-sufficiency, definitely. Getting your own business, keeping your credit clean, going to school, taking care of yourself, eating right, that sort of thing. And definitely not getting or receiving any assistance from the government whatsoever. That's what they believed in. Just starting their own business and just doing for self. So Musa was not with the Nation of Islam. He was more, he called himself, seeing Islam has so many different sects. So he was under the Shiite. Shiite. Mm-hmm. And they were a little bit more hardcore, if you will. Sunni Muslims are a little bit more docile and peaceful. Mm-hmm. They don't stir up a lot of rhetoric. Talk about America and talk about this and that. Just anti-hate. You know, that's what a lot of others are doing. And it's bad because that's not really the way Islam is at all. It's just funny how man just turns religion around to fit their own propaganda. It's just sad.
We've seen it so often through history. I mean, it's literally used as an excuse for these awful actions.
Isn't that terrible, though? And I don't understand that, because if you're a true believer of any faith, you know, God watches everything you do. Aren't you afraid, to do that? It's just beyond me how people would just manipulate the system or the religion and make people follow them.
And then you wonder if they actually believe it, or if it's a convenient excuse,
Exactly. Hey, there you go. That's what I wonder too, because it just didn't fit the bill at all. You know, he was just really rigid.
In your opinion, what snapped inside him to make him do what he did? Like, it sounds like the religion was great. You know, it sounds like he had a normal upbringing. So what the heck snapped? Like, was this monster created? Was he born? You know, we ask that almost every week, but what do you think?
Gosh. Well, hearing the history later, once we got out that situation, because I got a lot of my information from the DA, Julie Baldwin, and he's had prior problems in the home. Way before I came into the scene, child abuse issues. I think he had lost custody of his oldest son. The way he disciplined, I think what happened, he took his boot and slammed down on his right pinky finger and severed it. So, you know, definitely social services got involved on that case, and child was removed and given to his mother. So he stayed in Virginia with his grandparents.
It's the best thing that could have happened, it sounded like.
Yeah, really. But so it sounds like he's always been like this, you know? What makes people tick like that? I have no idea. I really don't.
For you, it sounded like the worst of it started when you were essentially locked in the garage.
Yeah.
You had no idea how long you were going to be there at that point, which had to be a pretty awful feeling. Just this endless time just ceased to exist.
Let me tell you, I was in that situation 3 to 4 years. And that last year was the year that you could see a total change. It was just like, oh my God, who is this? You know, I can't say he snapped, maybe, because he was doing some bizarre things and I really wanted out the situation. He didn't trust me anymore because he knew I've tried several times. And that's when he decided to put me in the garage, me and my children.
What had you tried before?
Oh gosh, it was all kind of techniques. I remember once I saw one of the kids' pictures laying in the living room. It was a little small, little photo. And I took it and I wrote help on the back of it. And when we were outside raking the grass and cleaning up the yard, I threw it over in the neighbor's yard, hoping someone would see it, you know?
Yeah.
Because we weren't allowed to talk to anybody or go anywhere. No one was allowed to ever come over at all. So you had no communication with people at all, none. Mm-hmm. And the house is like doom and gloom because it was always blinds are closed and shut tight. It was always dark, you know, inside. It was just kind of scary. But I tried that way. It was another time when him and his daughter, he took both of us to the store. And we lived in this last place in Awanga. It's real rural, up in the mountains of Temecula. So you have to go into the bottom of town for everything from the post office to gas station to whatever, you know, grocery store. So I was in the grocery store with them and I was just trying out, looking around, you know, you can't talk to anybody. He's right there. So I decided to go. I told him I didn't feel well. I was going to the restroom. So him and his daughter waited outside the door while I went in. My thing was, I thought maybe someone would come in, you know, behind me.
Yeah, right.
Talk to them real quick, you know, or tell them what's happening. Maybe they can get help for me. But no one ever came in. And then I looked around. It was nothing to write anything down with, or it was just like, that was just a dud of a plan right there. It didn't work.
And you had to know that as you, all these plans you were concocting, you had to know that any one of them could have got you caught.
Oh, did it. I thought this last one did, because when I came out, because it took so long, he was whispering, talking to his daughter. And then he had her to go into the restroom. And I can hear from the outside, you know, I could hear each stall door opening and shutting, you know, like she was checking his feet. Right. Yeah. If I did something, left something, you know, what was taking so long? But she came out the restroom and she looked at him. She kind of shook her head and held her head down. I guess that's giving him a sign. Nope, she didn't find anything.
You're lucky.
So, yeah. I'm kind of glad I didn't leave anything behind, because that would have been, I would have been totally busted.
I guess this is a complex question, but how did you survive? There had to be, without knowing, it's not like you had to know, like you have to survive this for 6 months. It was just this, everything was locked, everything was closed, and you were just there. So what gave you the will to try to stick this out?
My children, you know, I watched them every night as I was laying on this little cot on the floor. And I say, you know, I said to my son, too, I got you into this mess, and I'm going to get you guys out of it, because it's, you know, they didn't deserve this at all. And you just, you stay alive for them. You do all you can for them. And when I found, you know, I started looking at some of the old boxes in that garage, it was so much junk in there in the corners. And that's when I had saw the paper. It was like an old legal pad, real long yellow one. Mm-hmm. And didn't have a lot of papers left on it, maybe about 10 to 12 sheets. But I said, that was enough for me just to write something down. And when you're in that state like that, you don't know. You're just doing things off impulse, because you don't know. Once I wrote everything, I said, well, now what am I going to do with it? You know, you can't mail it. You can't just hand it to nobody. So you got this, all this information in this letter. I mean, I wrote everything down from what he was doing to us, everything, the names of everyone in the house. I even drew like a little map where we were on there, too.
Wow. So you're telling me that you wrote that letter without a plan of how to get it to someone. It was
I'll tell you what,
because if you get caught with that letter, that was it.
I thought he would definitely kill this. Definitely. That's why I kind of folded up and I slept with it. I kept it right in my underwear every night. I wouldn't put it nowhere because I'd be so scared, you know, he would find it.
Yeah. how did you help your children cope? Because obviously you knew the situation, the gravity of it, but your children, and in the one, I think it was that Sojourn from Hell show, Miriam said you would just kind of like try to calm them, like just tell them, shh, like just soothing.
And it was a nightmare. Sometimes I look back and go, how did I do it myself? You know, it's bad enough you're trying to keep you together, but now you got two more others you're trying to keep together. Plus you have a baby who's separated from you totally and in the house, and you hear her, but you can't touch her. I mean, I was just losing my mind between all of that going on.
And, I can't even imagine, Laura.
That's why, they didn't put that part in the movie. And it's so much, it's hard to put almost 3-4 years of everything into an hour and a half of anything.
You see the shows that we do. I mean, we have sometimes these cold cases take 30 years to solve, and we have 42 minutes to tell this whole story. It's just, you got to pick and choose.
it leaves so many open gaps of questions for people. People just like, what happened? This, and that. Because you can't fill it all. You just really can't. Right. And we're just trying to keep the kids together. Sometimes we did games. I tried to make it seem like a game to me. If you remember that movie, oh, God, it's a beautiful life. And he's sitting up there in a concentration camp with his son. And he didn't want to scare his son totally to death, but what all the surroundings around him. So he tried to make things like it's a game. And I just try to do that with them too. But it was hard. It really was hard because when they were here and the screams and everything going on in the house where Musa would just start beating on his children. I remember how Med said to me one time, Mommy, is he playing?
And you probably had to just be like, yeah, or just make something up to make him feel better.
To make them feel better. I said, yeah, I think they're just play acting. They're doing a play or something, honey. You know, anything. Yeah, just to keep their mind off of the horror that was really going on.
Laura, were your friends and family, were they looking for you? Were they like, what happened? Where did you go?
Yeah, I found out later on after we were out of that situation from Detective Zirkle. He was a detective handling the case, and he was there on the scene. He told me that my family had a missing persons out on me, and also my husband did too. Because at one time we were talking, I was talking to my sister, but then all of a sudden all communication stopped, and she had no way to reach me. And, when I did talk to her last, or any time I talked to her on the phone, Musa will always have the other phone in his hand so he could stand there and listen to the conversation. I mean, he'll stand right there in front of you with the phone in his hand. So, he wasn't hiding or anything.
No secret,
But he just want to watch everything you say, And it's that look he gave you, if you look like you said something wrong. So, yeah, they were looking for me. They sure were. I kind of like just disappeared off the grid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you wrote that letter first, how long did you have it? And what kind of made you say, all right, this is it. I got to figure out a way.
I had that letter for several months, I would say, because I would write at night when everyone was asleep. I would just write something down and it just turned into, about 10, 12 pages. And then I would flip over and write on the back. Wow. And anything. I started writing on the sides because I was running out of room.
Where's the letter now?
I got a picture of it. I'll send it to you. Yeah.
Please do.
It's still, I think it was destroyed because the way I wrote the letter to the sheriff's department, Julie told me to request for any evidence. That it belongs to you because it's yours. And even the tape, because I had tapes too.
Yeah.
But I found out when they wrote me back and they said, no, all evidence was kept at a certain time period and then it was destroyed. Wow. So Yeah, but at least I took a picture of it before it, you know.
Yeah.
It left. Yeah, before they took it and destroyed it, though. Yeah.
So how scared were you at the post office?
You don't even want to know. I mean, I needed two or three briefs on, I'll be honest mm-hmm. with you, because I feel like I want to wet my pants. I was just trembling, you know, because I said, well, okay. Once again, I got this letter, got it on me. He's right there behind me, too, in line. Mm-hmm. How do I do make this work? Do I just drop it on the floor and hopefully somebody pick it up? Or do I, what do I do with it?
You know, right.
And he's going to see me, you know? So that's why I say it was nothing but God. You got to believe in something. Whatever your how your power is, believe. Because out of the blue, this guy just came up and started talking to him, you know?
Wow.
Just distracted him. Just enough time, because it was one lady in front of me. And when she left, it was just me and the clerk.
Wow.
And I had the little note off the door that they, you know, tell you have a package in town. Mm-hmm. And I gave it to her and I signed for it. And she went in the back and got the package. And all it was food stamps I applied for.
Mm-hmm.
And only I could retrieve it because I had to have my ID with me.
Wow.
He was still talking. I could hear him, the guy behind me, just striking up a conversation, talking about the town, you know, how you like it out here, where you from, that kind of thing. They're just talking. And she looked at me kind of odd, because everything I did, I was just shaking.
Sure.
And I started to pull up my dress in front of her, just right in front of her, so no one else could see me. And I reached inside my underwear and I pulled this letter out and I put it on the counter. And I kind of looked over my shoulder just slightly, not all the way at him, because I didn't want him to know I was looking at him, you know, give it away.
Right.
But I kind of slid the letter towards her. I didn't even go halfway close to her. She took it from me and she put it up underneath the counter real quick. And she looked over her shoulder, you know, and I said, oh, my God, thank you. You know, and at that time, I really thought he saw me. I really did, because he yelled out my name. And I was like, huh? And he said, what's taking so long?
But it was more of
so
like, let's go. Yeah,
that's right. What's taking so long, you know? And I told him, I'm signing for it now, you know? And I took the package she gave me. And he said, let's go. Let's get out of here. And we started towards the door. And thank goodness he walked in front of me, because I was able to look back at her, you know?
Give her
one last look, you know? And that's when she just nodded. She just nodded at me and let me know, I guess everything's going to be okay, you know, but we couldn't ever talk. So it was terrible. I was so nervous. It was that fear, your heart beating so loud, you can hear it in your ears. It's just.
You were probably nervous even after you left, because you're like, well, now what if he finds out now somehow?
Yeah. On the way back to the house. And he was driving, you know, I'm still trembling, still nervous.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, all kind of negative thoughts come in your head, you know, is she going to lose it? Maybe she might throw it away. She won't even read it. And there's all that work I put into that, you know, it's gone. I couldn't even start all over, you know, just no way I could recreate that. I don't even have the paper anymore to do it.
Right.
So everything was just running through. And instead of positive things like, yeah, she's going to get us help, we're going to get out of here, I was thinking negative.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how you've been trained. I mean, that you've been brainwashed to think negative of all the things that were going on.
And plus all my other plans failed. So why would this work? You know, when I got back to the garage, I was scared to even tell my son. I didn't even tell him. Because I didn't want to get their hopes up, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're gonna be rescued. Just wait and see. I wouldn't even do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one thing we talked about last week, and I wanted to ask you, do you think if the postal worker was a man and not a woman, would he have understood that? Do you think a male postal worker, I feel like, Ed, you're great. but not all men are like that intuitive and that, like, I feel like women can almost speak with their eyes to each other, yeah. whereas yeah. like men are just kind of there. So I feel like,
wow. Wow.
You're lovely.
I know what you're saying. Exactly. And that's a good question too, because I remember an incident with a young lady trying to call for help. She was in a domestic violence situation and she called a pizza place because he wanted her to order a pizza. If you remember that one.
I do.
And yeah, the guy, he didn't pick up on it in the very beginning, you know, because she kept asking, you know, acting odd and not answering all his questions when he asked what you want on the pizza. But eventually, right. it was something about maybe her tone or I don't know, but it clicked in. He did come to and kind of like, are you okay? You know, and she wouldn't answer it. He knew mm-hmm. then, you know. Yeah. All he wanted was an address at that point. You know, where can I deliver this pizza? And when she gave the address, he got her help. So it's hard to say, you know, if you're in person with a guy or a girl. Yeah. How would that be? Would the guy take it serious enough, or could he see it or pick up on anything?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The way I was trembling, he might have picked up on it if it was a guy. I was shaking so bad. And just that look in your eye of fear, you know?
Yeah. Well, then how long until the troops came? Was it the next day? Was it?
And believe it or not, it was not the next day. And that's what gave me the hope start going, in, you know, just dwindling away. It was really that next, the day after, that morning, early in the morning, maybe 4 or 5 in the morning. And I don't really know, to be honest with you, what took so long. I never did inquire or ask.
Right.
But yeah, it was not the very next day, but the day, that morning of the following day. Yeah. And oh boy, that was scary, because being up there in the mountains like that, you hear, it's totally just silent, you know, especially at night. You just hear crickets. And when I heard a car, I couldn't even sleep that night for some reason. I was just tossing back and forth thinking this letter is gone. I was just so worried. And both my kids were asleep. And I heard this car. And at first I thought, well, maybe they might be lost. But 3 or 4 in the morning, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the next thing, I didn't hear it anymore. I just heard the car door shut and then another car door shut. And then just start walking, like walking on gravel. You can hear the crunch, crunch. You know, it was getting louder. Like, they're coming this way. And then I didn't do anything. I just kind of sat there and I was scared. I don't know why I was scared. That's funny. But I remember hearing the kids in the house. I remember them running around and they kept saying, Daddy, 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 it's the police. Because they were looking out. I guess they looked out the corner of the window. They must have heard the car too.
Yeah.
And boy.
His stomach must have dropped.
Oh boy. I tell you, Ed. Oh man. Like, this is it. Why else the police be there? 3 or 4 in the morning. It's got to be about this letter. It's got to be.
So I need to ask you this, because this came to my mind when I hadn't thought about it ever until we were talking about it last week. And that you've seen it before, where a situation like that, and I don't mean to be blunt about this, but it could have turned into a very easily a mass murder suicide situation, where he sees the police show up. Knowing how he's wired, he could have done unspeakable things in that house.
Oh yeah, definitely. And people kill me when they always say things like, well, you know, if it was all that bad, why didn't you just leave? Are you kidding? You know, they kill me when they ask that. They really do. And they have no idea. They're not in your shoes. This guy was it's like walking on eggshells with him. You know, you had to be very careful. He had weapons in the house. He had knives in the house. He had guns in the house. Wow. And I knew he wasn't going to go down without a fight. I knew that if he ever was surrounded like that, and you're right, Ed, my fear was he would kill everyone in that house and then turn the gun on himself. You hear about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, no. Yeah, it could happen to us instantly. But for some reason, by them coming that early in the morning, it caught him off guard. And he wasn't prepared. Really, he was just woke up, you know. And he came out. I can hear him come out in the hallway. You know, you can hear outside the garage door because the inside, you know, the door is in the house. And I could hear everything going on. And what was so funny about it, when they started knocking on the door, and they weren't even knocking. The police, when they say they bang, they bang. Mm-hmm. And they were banging. Boom, 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 boom. Like the whole house shook, you know? But this one thing that was really odd, Musa always, he locked all the doors, the patio door in the back, the front door, with these big, huge bike chains. And I never had a chance to ever talk to, it was Deputy Fogle was his, the officer's name, from the Sheriff's, Riverside County Sheriff Department. And I always wanted to ask him, what was he thinking? Because Musa had to first unlock the lock off the chain, unravel the chain off the doors. You know, the chain just falling on the floor.
Yeah.
And I know they can hear that on the other end, on the other side of the door. I wonder what they were thinking. And he finally opened the door. And I could hear a little muffling, mumble noise talking, but I couldn't make out what it was said, what was being said. Then I heard the door shut again. And I thought, that's odd. He shut the door on the police? And then my door opened, the door that led into the garage. It opened up. And he looked in there and he says, the police are out here and they're asking for you. You know what this is about? And I go, no, I don't know. Well, get out here and see what they want and get them off my property. That's all he said. And I started to walk out and I had the kids with me. He said, no, they stay here. You come on out here. And I looked back at little Muhammad and I'm like, oh God, he just looked so sad. Like, are you coming back, mama?
Yeah.
And I went on out there and Musa was right behind me. He was so close, Ed, that you can feel a breath on my neck. Mm. He was that close behind me.
Oh.
And I opened the door and there was Officer Fogle. And he had another officer with him on the side. And he had this paper in his hand, but it didn't look like my letter. But it found out it was my letter. It was just a copy. Yeah. And it wasn't the yellow one. It wasn't the original.
Yeah.
He asked me, are you Laura Cowan? I go, yes. And then he started to raise the letter up and goes, I know he was going to say, did you write this? You know, but then I kind of gave him the eyes. Like, you know, he picked up on it because he stopped talking in midstream.
Melissa, men are intuitive. See?
Okay, that's a police officer. So
that's a police officer. He picked up on the body language really quick. He sure did.
Have you kept in touch with him or anybody like the postal worker?
Yes. Oh. I would say years later, David Kelly from the LA Times and his photographer came out to do an interview about, you know, the situation. Matter of fact, they did like a little multimedia piece. You know, they did, they showed pictures, everything, because they had interviewed all the kids back there too. And then they wanted to come out and interview me. And I remember getting a call a few days later from Irfan, his photographer. And he says, I went back to take some more pictures at the post office and guess who I ran into? I said, who? He said, I ran into Ruth. Ruth? Who's Ruth?
Yeah, you didn't know her name.
I didn't know her name. He said, that's the postal worker who rescued you. I said, are you kidding? She's still there? He said, yeah, she's still there. You want to talk to her? And I'm like, oh my God, I can, yeah. And so he put her on the phone and she goes, hi, Laura. And I go, oh my God, Ruth. You know, I was just like, oh, thank you so much for everything. Yeah. And she goes, girl, I know I felt it. I saw it on your face and you were nervous. I knew something was wrong.
You saved your life.
Yeah, saved my life. Wow. So I thanked her.
Unbelievable. Well, your story is so heroic. And I want to talk about briefly some of the aftermath, because I imagine that once you were free from this situation, it had to take years to recover from. And I'm guessing therapy and just learning how to be normal again.
Therapy, man. We were in therapy for over 8 years, Ed, me and the kids. Oh my gosh, we had to. We've had art therapy. We had group therapy. We had single one-on-one therapy. We had pet therapy. We had everything.
All the therapy.
I know. And especially the children, because they, you know, oh yeah.
From what I've seen, just from following a little bit, I mean, they look like they're doing great.
Yeah. Yeah. My children are, but unfortunately, like I said, when I talked to the DA too a long time ago after that, his children really suffered a lot. They were, they never received therapy. Ugh. They were separated because they were in, like, social workers put them in different group homes, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was just really hard for them. Really, really hard. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Wow.
Well, that kind of leads into what I'm hoping isn't a sore subject, but I could see if it was, and we can cut it out if it is. But I want to talk for a second about that Dr. Phil episode, because I saw that come up and I was honestly shocked, because when I click on that and I saw the faces that were involved, I thought it was going to be a story of hope and about a reunion. And I turn it on and it's basically four, and if you count the people in the crowd, 8-1 saying,
right,
you're full of it.
Right. Exactly.
What's your impression of that whole situation?
Oh man, it was so terrible. The main reason I came on that show, it was mostly to reunite, you know, Taslima with them. Because I have to tell you, their mindset back then, Ed, when they were little, was totally brainwashed. And they had no, I mean, Musa was it to them. He was the voice. He told them when to eat, when to go to sleep, when to wake up, what to do, what to dress, everything. And it was no outside relatives, family. They didn't even go to school. They were homeschooled.
Wow.
So he was the center of their life. He's all they knew. So they just gravitate on everything, you know, that he said, what must be true, must be, you know, legit. But
right
after everything was over with, you know, and he was found guilty and he was sentenced to 7 consecutive life terms. I remember one day Julie Baldwin called me and she goes, the kids would like to reach out to you. They wanted me to see if I could give them your number. And I said, you know, I kind of hesitated, you know, because I remember how they were back in that house. They weren't friendly. They weren't friendly at all, mm-hmm. but they were just really following instructions of him. So that sure. I didn't. But I said, okay. You know, I went ahead and went along with it. And then we all did end up talking. And they were so, so humble and so, you know, grateful that, you know, I got them out of that situation. And we all became, I won't say friends, but we all became kind of mutual understanding mm-hmm. of Taslima's, their sisters. That's the main reason right. I wanted to reconnect with them. But later on, after that reunion, I saw a lot of stuff again. And I saw that those red flags popping up, you know, that mm-hmm. they weren't well. They weren't well at all. They had a lot of issues going on, a lot of hatred and anger. They wanted to borrow money all the time. And I was sending it to them. I did, because I wanted to help them. But it got to be too frequent. And then when you stop all of a sudden, they became really angry with you.
Yeah, you're the bad guy then.
Yeah, you're the bad guy. So it's like, I sat down and I had a talk with my daughter. And I said, you know, when you're 18 years old, you could probably do whatever you want. But right now, dear, I can think under my watch, we need to cut this off. We really do. It's not going to work. It's not. It's just something about them. It's just not going to work. And she was in agreement, too, after talking to them. She didn't feel comfortable either around them much over the phone, the way they were behaving. So we decided, we were all on Facebook together, everything. You know what I'm saying? So I unfriended him, and she did too. And that's when the hell started, you know? When you block your number.
Yep.
It's so sad because you guys were all in this together. And that's when I turned that on. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get to see Lara interact with the children. And then it was.
Right.
It was awful to see.
And I wasn't really, to be honest with you, I wasn't supposed to be up there, Ed. It was just supposed to be my daughter up there with them. But I don't know. Somehow Dr. Phil said, well, why don't you come out and tell your story? Like, I didn't think I was here for me, you know,
supposed to be here for
her. Wow. But then when I came out to tell my story, the next thing I know, they cut the break and they were bringing out chairs. And I'm like, well, one chair next to me, that's for Taz when she comes out. But what's this about, you know? And next thing you know, they all were, and they weren't looking happy. They were angry looking. You know,
believe you were blindsided.
It was like blindsided really badly. And even who came on the show with me was Detective Zirkle. He was on the show with me. And I remember Dr. Phil had asked him a question while he was sitting on the front row in the audience because he had the mic on. And I think he asked what was the conditions of the garage, something like that. So I remember when they started badgering me, you know, and saying this and that and everything else. I remember looking over at Detective Zirkle. He was actually talking, but his mic was cut off. So no one even heard anything what he was saying, you know?
And I looked
at Taz Lima and I said, you know, we should just get up and walk off this stage. Really, we really should.
Wouldn't have blamed you.
Yeah. But by that time, the show was almost really over. It was really over.
What's the point?
It was like, what's the point? Yeah, might as well just sit here. But yeah, it was really bad. All it was really was a team up against me kind of thing. And I feel sorry. I know that they had a lot of mental health issues behind all of this. I knew that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even want to say, to be honest with you, say anything negative to them, you know, because I really felt sorry for them. Really, I did.
Sure.
You know, and then I said, well, you know, anybody else would have been, it'd have been like a Jerry Springer show. You know, I'd have said something, they'd have said something, I would have said something, you know, now I'm not going.
Chair goes flying. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I'm not even going down that aisle. I'm not doing it. Yeah. So that's why, and it's just really unfortunate because I really thought maybe they would have a relationship with their sister. But after that one, she doesn't want anything to do with them whatsoever, ever, 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 ever. Then I find out later, Ed, I find out again after this movie came out too, I found out from the DA because I wanted her to watch it, you know, and I talked to her about it. And she told me that they're actually, I don't know how she finds these things out, but she knows. She said they're actually going and visiting him at the jail. They're talking, they're having conversation.
Huh.
And my mouth dropped. Like, oh my God, he still got a hold on them. Yeah. He really still got a hold on them. They'll never be free. He still got them. They're grown adults now. They're in their 30s.
But that's, I think, why they treated you the way they did. They've been brainwashed their whole life.
Mm-hmm. All their life. Yeah. And it's so, gosh, I just can't believe that somebody is that powerful. They got a hold on you set that deeply like that. But yeah. Yeah.
Unreal, yeah. Laura.
It is unreal.
Let's talk. We're going to wrap up soon, but I want to talk about your real purpose in life. You're the victim advocacy, because that's what I think that's what you were put on this earth to do. Honest to God. So we've covered a lot of super heavy cases lately, and many of which were murders that started with domestic violence, because a lot of them do, unfortunately. So what advice would you give our listeners if they suspect a friend or a loved one is in a troubled relationship?
If you suspect a friend or a loved one, because I know a lot of family wants to help and reach out and do things for people. And when they're in that situation. But my thing is this, you don't want to get totally involved, because you can end up involved, if you know what I mean. So you want to be safe about it. You just want to maybe have resources available. You want to maybe to talk to that person, listen to them, because a lot of times we don't listen. We like to overtalk people. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a good ear. And you really have to be not judgmental, too, because when a victim is telling you their story and they're telling you what's happening to them, don't put yourself in their shoes. Like, well, I would have did this if I were you. You don't know what you would have done, you know, in that situation. So just be, you know, compassionate, be understanding, have resources for them, and encourage them, you know, let them know that you're there for them. Mm-hmm. And eventually they will find the path, and they'll know that you're, you know, they'll come to you for help when they're ready. Because a lot of women, they leave situations, but they go back. Mm-hmm. They weren't really totally ready. So they have to be ready, and they'll know when they're ready. You know when you're ready to go. So just, again, just be a good listener to them when they talk to you, and just try to offer them some support and resources, mostly to help them with the situation, because you're not the professional, but you want to make sure they get the professional help. Yeah. That's why I say never go to family and relatives and want to stay with them, because they're not the doctor and nurses. They're not the professionals.
And they all have advice like they are, though.
Have advice. It is not always good advice, you know? They might mean well, but
And
most families, they got that motto now, you know, whatever happens in the home stays in the home. Like, they don't want to talk about it to anybody else. And that's an old taboo we need to get out of. We really do.
Yeah.
Really do.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So working now with the housing authority, I run across a lot of young people. I would even say young men. But men go through it too now. They do. That goes through domestic violence, and just trying to get them the assistance and resources and help them maybe relocate. But sometimes they have to move just for their own safety. This is the things I do.
Unbelievable story. Well, and it was a story that warranted a Lifetime movie. Not everybody can say they're the subject of a Lifetime movie. And Melissa actually just watched it the other night and had trouble getting through it just because of all the...
I had to turn it off. I couldn't handle it. I'm sorry.
Just watching what was going on.
Melissa, all I can tell you is Lifetime is really soft, because they did hardly show anything like what was really going on in there. Yeah.
I couldn't handle it.
Oh, yeah. They really showed. I mean, Ed knows some of it because he's had, you know, the case with me. He would beat the children so bad. He would punish them when they didn't know the different Quran verses, because they had to recite all the time. He would make them eat their own vomit when they vomit. He would shove feces in their mouth. It was all kind of things, huh? Oh my gosh. And I know Lifetime could not show that. It's just nowhere in the world. Maybe Netflix could have, but not.
Maybe Netflix.
Not Lifetime.
Mm-mm. Wow, no, definitely not.
Definitely not. Oh my gosh. I tell you about the honey scene.
No.
No.
For one of the punishments for the kids, I think it was the oldest one too. Musa had some rice in a bowl, and they went in the refrigerator Because one time, I guess he didn't lock it up because he usually put chains around the refrigerator door. And they got into that rice. He had a fit. He had them all lined up. And they show that part in the movie, too. And he went down the road, each one, you know, this, who stole my rice? And when he got to his oldest son, he wouldn't tell him. So what he did, he sent them all to their room. And he went in the backyard and he dug this hole. Took a while, but he dug a hole. Then he told Jahad to come out there, his son, and he put him in that hole. Then he poured honey on top of his head. Now, it didn't compute what was going on. But later on, I could hear Jahad started screaming because the ants had covered his. Yeah, covered them instantly. Them big red ants, they were all over and biting them. And yeah, that he told who ate the rice. He sure did. But that was some of the torture techniques he used.
Mm-hmm. We were supposed to end on something happy. Why'd you do?
Sorry.
I want to know. I know there's a picture, so you've met her, but I thought the actress who played you was adorable. And I loved the beginning with you and Shabazz meeting. Like, I thought that was so cute. They were adorable. Yeah. I was telling Ed, I was like, it was such a meet cute. Like, they did. I felt like they had a very good chemistry, the two of them together.
Mm-hmm. That's Paige. Paige Hurd. She's so sweet. I met her and she was just adorable. I did a couple of Zoom calls with her because she just wanted to talk to me and just, you know, just get my mannerisms down, you know? And I said, honey, just be you, whatever you do, because you no one could be me. Mm-hmm.
That's a fact. No one is you.
She did an excellent job, Ed. She really did. But Stephen had a hard time, though. Stephen Bishop, he played Musa because he said it was no pictures out there, no footage, no video. So he really couldn't get the, you know, the character down.
Sure.
I told him, Stephen, just be as evil as you can. Cool and mild manner, you know. Mm-hmm. You'll get your point across. And he did well. He sure did.
That'd have to be a weird experience, directing someone how to act as the man who did all these bad things to you.
Isn't that weird? It is weird because, you know, they made me co-producer on this project too.
No kidding.
Yeah, Lifetime, they sure did. They had me co-producer. I got the script. We went through it, edited, took some stuff out, put some stuff in. It was like, they sure did. They flew me out there and I had to, that's where I met most of the cast. And we sat down and went over a few scenes. So he picked up well. He did very good. That inner self had to come out, you know?
Yeah. I'm so excited for you that this movie, I know I've been catching all the posts about it and then we checked it out. It's just, I'm so happy for you that this ended with something on a positive note, that you have turned this whole situation into something positive.
Yeah. Could you imagine when this was happening? Like, you'd be sitting here with a Lifetime movie. That's so wild.
Right. Now, while I was sitting in that garage, that was never the thought. Never the thought. Didn't see that coming at all whatsoever. I kept seeing death. That's all I kept seeing. I said, we're not going to get out of here. Someone's going to die in this house. We're not going to get out alive. But there you go. God had the other vision. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ed, for everything. Thank you for being so patient because, you know, you don't want to interview me.
I can't thank you enough for being here. And I'm proud to call you a friend, Laura. Seriously, thank you.
Thank you so much. And in closing, I will say this real quick, though, Ed and Melissa, listen carefully. You never know who's listening to your podcast, my dear. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because I had gotten a DM on Facebook from the producer. And he said he heard my story on a podcast, because we did a podcast here in Cleveland. It was a true crime podcast on Channel 19 called The Dark Side, and he heard the story. And he said, oh, this would be a great movie. So they researched, they tried to find me, you know, and he couldn't find me. And he saw my Facebook page and he DM'd me, and the rest is history.
Man, so hear that, Melissa? Big things.
Yeah.
Big things on the horizon. So, Laura, before we wrap up, what do you want to plug? When's your radio show on? Where can people find it? When does it air?
Yeah, it airs every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's called Dear Miss Laura, and it's on WOBU. That's 95.9 FM. Of course, you can't hear because you're not, you know, in town to be on the radio to listen. You can always go to the website, though. That's www.wovu.org, and click on the Listen Live button at the top on Mondays. And it airs every Monday, 1 o'clock. And we talk about everything from domestic violence, 101, human trafficking, you name it. I've had a couple of guests on my show, Ed. I'm going to tell you one you know personally.
Oh.
I've had Mildred Muhammad on my show.
No kidding.
Yeah, she's the wife, the ex-wife of the DC sniper.
Yeah.
Wow. He's been on my show to talk about him. Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
I've had Tanya Brown on my show, and she's the baby sister of Nicole Brown.
Yep.
She's been on, too. So, and we became good friends after that. And people always ask you, well, how did you get these people? How did you, all I did was went to LinkedIn and just inbox them and say, hey.
People are more cooperative than you think.
Yeah.
Right. It was no PR person to block you or, you know, yeah. So.
It's like, if you don't ask, you'll never find out. So it
doesn't
hurt.
You go. There you go. Huh?
Oh, Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, it's great meeting you. And thank you for this.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you, Melissa. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Well, there you have
it.
Wow. The tale of Laura Cowan.
That was intense. And I don't know how she stays so it reminds me of Jody from Block 3, just like how she's so sweet and kind and still has faith in humanity.
She's just so nice too. She's so pleasant to work with all the time. Every time we talk, and she's so eager to tell her story, to keep getting the word out. Like, don't let people forget what happened, which is so important.
So important. Well, we have one more episode coming up in this block, and I'm covering that next week. And it is a doozy, but it's all about how a fairy tale romance can go so badly so quickly. And I might tell you a really good poem about Nantucket next week, but we'll see.
Will it rhyme? That's all I want
to know. Oh, absolutely it will. Just think about what rhymes with Nantucket.
Can I guess 4 words that it will be?
Yes. And listeners, if you want to guess, you can hit us up on our socials, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, at Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can go on our website with all the www.murderunscriptedpod.com. And I think that is all we have today. And just be careful out there.
You never know what situation is going to turn very bad.
And I'm going to say it again. You never know who's a pervert because they don't wear signs.
Is that too much to ask?
Seriously.
Yeah.
Bye.